Hello, Mind Hackers. It's your host, Cody McLean. With the current state of the world, it can be easy to feel stuck. I, myself, have been finding it increasingly difficult to maintain the motivation and productivity levels that I had pre-COVID times. It brings me back to a conversation I had back in 2018 with Nick Winter, the CEO of CodeCombat.com and author of the book, The Motivational Hacker. I think this interview may be even more relevant than it was back then, so I decided to brush off the dust and bring it back from the archives. Nick Winter taught me how to create good habits, learn new skills, and push myself to achieve more. I want you to learn as I have, so you can continue to be the best version of yourself. So without further ado, here is Nick Winter. Nick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Cody, thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you. And Nick, I am absolutely thrilled to be having this conversation with you because ever since I read your book, I've sort of put you on my list of favorite people. And also, before we get started, I also want to thank Malcolm Ocean, one of your friends, who is also the founder of Complice.co, who I interviewed on a previous episode that introduced us.
Yeah, Malcolm's super great. He's one of the all-time most thoughtful guys when it comes to setting up productivity routines.
I know. I connected incredibly well with him and was just fascinated by his own software, Complice.co, where I felt like he was trying to solve something that I hadn't seen being solved by anything else. But we could get into that. I'm going to hold off on that. And I actually wanted to come back to your book and say that your book, The Motivation Hacker, I'm not exactly sure how I came across it, but it was an absolutely mind-blowing read when I read it. And it didn't have a tone of being on a high horse like many self-help books I've read. And it came across to me as just a regular guy who just wants to get ahead. But the difference between you and everybody else is that you put in a lot of time, effort, and energy into trying to figure out just how to do that. You've logged your hypotheses, your experiments in the book, while building on the knowledge of many other great authors and scientific studies about willpower, motivation, procrastination, and the like. Now, even though your book is a few years old, it's honestly one of the best self-help books I've ever read. And I'm honestly curious, what inspired you to write that book?
Well, first, Cody, thanks for the praise for the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was on this flight to San Francisco. So I was moving to California. And on the flight, the idea came to me. I had been working just on my startup Scritter for so long, I didn't really know how to do anything else besides be super productive on my main focus. And I just had this vision come over me on the plane of, if I keep doing it like this, my life will still only have one purpose and I won't be able to kind of taste all these other areas or develop in all these other ways because I'll just set into the same habits that I've always done. So it was that plane flight that gave me the perspective and kind of took me away from the day to day where I was able to do longer term, more strategic thinking. The idea just came to me that, well, I've been thinking about these different things that I could try doing, things I could get into. Maybe I should try some new hobbies. Maybe I should do some other missions. And one of these being writing a book, I just thought, well, what if I did all those things at the same time and wrote a book about it and how to get myself to be so productive that I could not have to choose and I could just have all the things I wanted in life at the same time. And that's what was the original drive.
Do you think it's possible to be too productive in a sense, though, where you're absolutely obsessing over work and being productive? Because I know that's something I've been through. And I actually wrote a blog post where I referenced productivity porn because I was absolutely so obsessed with reading productivity articles that it actually was taking priority over real work. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh, this is work. I'm learning, right? But then it just became an obsession. Did you ever have that kind of issue?
Yeah, well, the first point I'll make to that is that like more productivity is good. Getting more stuff that you want to do done is just good. The problem is if you neglect other things, and you can absolutely be too productive focused on kind of in your main mission, whether that's work or study or reading productivity articles, whatever it is, if you aren't giving enough kind of productive energy to other areas in your life. But my solution to that is always to identify the areas where I'm not spending enough time and focus, and then be more productive in focusing on those areas, even areas where it doesn't normally make sense, like in your romantic relationships. You can absolutely set like productivity goals on that. And people say, well, doesn't it kind of make it a little bit inauthentic if you are setting a goal for like how many dates you go on or how many romantic gestures that you give your significant other? And I would say it's not nearly as big an issue with most people as like the benefit that you would gain from really being mindful about really how much you are putting in versus what you would intend to. So I think that balance comes from being more applying productivity systems to more areas of your life, as opposed to only applying them to one area and letting the others slide.
And to add on to that, I think a part of importance of setting goals is that we all have these ideas of like, you know, losing weight or something. But the biggest issue we have is that we have that commitment issue where we set an intention, you know, at the beginning of the new year. And then, you know, I think there was a study that showed everybody shows up at the gym for the first few weeks, but then it just dies off like 50% because we lose that motivation. And that's the importance of setting a goal, even if it's, as you say, to like have 10 dates, you know, because likely I've met a lot of people who are lonely and they want to be in a relationship, but they don't have the motivation. But if you set some kind of goal with yourself and then maybe you use a pre-commitment device, which we can talk about later, then that can help kind of push you over that mountain, that obstacle, right? Or that, as Stephen Pressfield refers to, the resistance.
I think most of the resistance is usually coming from people's expectations of failure, or potentially even more importantly, lack of expectations of success. Once you've built a habit and you consistently start doing the thing, then the default prediction for tomorrow is that you'll also consistently start doing the thing. There's no decision about whether to do it or not. There's no fear about whether you failed to do it because you are already doing it. You always have done it. So a lot of things that we do are built on these habits of success. And when you start trying to do a new thing in a new area, especially an area that you're not satisfied with, probably because you haven't been working on it. And that's the gym fitness New Year's resolution is like the prime example of this, but there's so many. Then your default base rate is that you don't do it. So there's a lot of activation energy, a lot of resistance to doing it. But more than that, you've probably tried some things like this before and failed. So your default prediction is that you'll fail again. And that makes it even harder because every time you go to do the thing, you have to wrestle with kind of the self-doubt that you will achieve the long-term results. And that makes it easier to kind of give up and not put in the short-term effort. Whereas if you knew you were going to succeed in the long-term, then you wouldn't even really be thinking about that and it would just make things much easier. And this is something that in the book I call the expectancy factor in your motivation equation. So that with the New Year's resolution piece, you know, there's so many hacks that you can get into, pre-commitment, success spirals, all these things. But that piece, like a lot of it is aimed at making yourself feel like you will succeed to take away kind of the decision point of whether to put in the effort or do the time or do the work.
And when it comes to feeling like something, you know, I think we have like affirmations, you know, right, that you could listen to that I am successful, I am happy. But, you know, internally, you still might feel depressed and loathing yourself. So how do you recognize this internal view of, say, you expect to fail, but inside of your head, you might be telling yourself, I'm going to win, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. How do you bridge that intent with what you actually embody from a feeling perspective?
Well, I think the key is to start small in terms of what you set your goals are. If you do have those kind of feelings of self-doubt, I mean, setting goals where you can definitely put in the input can make it really easy. For example, not I want to write the next great novel, but like I want to write one word per day, or not like, oh, I definitely want to become fluent in Chinese, or even like I want to put in an hour a day, but it's like, let me just get 5 minutes per day. These kind of things, even if you deep inside are not sure, you have the doubt whether you can do this thing or not, the most important thing is still to show up and find out. And surely you can find somewhere where you can average, you know, 20 minutes a week on your goal. And if you show up, maybe you do more, maybe you get into habit, you can raise the thresholds over time, but you want to start small where that voice of your inner critic is just so ridiculous. Like if it says, oh, you can't even put 1 minute towards this, you're never going to do it. Like that's just silly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So giving, you can kind of marry that external image, that hope, that kind of ideal that you want to achieve, and tell people that you're working on that and commit to it externally, but do that in a way where you're definitely able to meet your commitments both externally and internally. And you can build that confidence in yourself over time until you're ready to take on much more ambitious goals, because some success leads to expectancy of more success.
And just to touch on the one aspect that you said about externalizing your goals, I actually just recently read an article that was based on a brand new study this year that seemed to say that if we tell other people our goals, then we're less likely to achieve them. I don't even think it's a new study. Have you heard about that one where it's actually better to not tell other people what you plan to do?
Yeah, there's a lot going back and forth on this. I think Derek Sivers had a piece kind of exploring the nuances of this. People ran with it and took it really out of context. He published a follow-up. At the end of the day, there's pros and cons for doing it. I think if you do it in the right format, the pros certainly outweigh the cons. What you don't want is to tell people in a way that it makes you feel good, like you already have achieved it, because they give you this kind of positive social affirmation.
Because I think in their mind, when you tell them that you're going to, say, run a 5K, then they already view you as somebody who ran a 5K. And so then it makes the goal less, it's like you have less desire to achieve it. It's kind of what I remember saying, interestingly enough.
Yeah, and I don't have the science on this. I don't know if anybody has really good science. These kind of studies often fail to replicate or just are not really generalizable past what their tiny experimental sample was. But it does seem that in the case where you want to run a 5K and that's what motivates you, then it's probably more helpful to tell all your friends that you are going to train 3 times a week than that you are going to run a 5K, if that's really what kind of is your hang up, right? Mm-hmm. If training is no problem, but actually showing up for race day is kind of the thing that you're worried you won't do, then yeah, tell your friends that you're going to do the 5K, have them come watch. Like if you make commitments where you'd be letting them down if you don't go, what that does is it helps you, when the time comes to act, have those commitments that help create a forcing function for you to get the future you to do what present you wants future you to want to do.
And that's partly pre-commitment. And I think you even mentioned the story of the Spanish sailor who burns all of his boats so none of his men can retreat. And so can you tell me again some other examples perhaps of what a pre-commitment device is? And also I know we have Stick, and you mentioned BeeMinder in your book several times. And I've tried to get myself to use these websites that attempt to ask you every week whether or not you're sticking to your goals. And then they allow you to either donate money to an organization you don't want, or you can also have somebody kind of chaperone you, like a friend or family member. But I've never really met somebody who's successfully been able to use really these external devices. And even as a side note, I remember, you know, that like the Pavlov watch that one guy came out with, and it was even on Shark Tank, and he was kind of laughed off, where if you do something that you don't want, you would shock yourself as like a negative reinforcement. But I think there's a lot more science behind positive reinforcement. But anyway, I'm going to stop talking and just ask for your comment.
Yeah, Manisha's Pavlov was pretty interesting. There's certain habits where negative reinforcement has some sort of like biological thing, especially with electric shock, that can make it sort of effective. But ideally, instead of manually giving yourself the shock, it would happen when you, exactly at the time at which you decided to do the aberrant behavior, right? Usually the recommended solution is like, well, eat the chip and then shock yourself to kind of establish that response. And it apparently kind of works for that certain narrow range, especially for things like eating, smoking, these kind of basic biological things. Whereas we want it to kind of automatically happen when we swear or say like or or something like this. And that's harder to enforce. As far as BeeMinder and Stick K though, Stick K is kind of just really bad UX. And you have these binary goals of like do the thing or not, you know, can connect you to people to check in with you and do that sort of thing. You know, it's okay. I view BeeMinder as really having the solution here in a way that a lot of these other ones don't. The core problem is almost all of acrasia, which is kind of the opposite of motivation, like not doing what you want to do, then procrastination, right? The core problem with this is the way that the motivation equation works, such that the long-term rewards are heavily discounted compared to the short-term consequences and costs. So in any time that you want something in the future, you still don't want to put in the work now because the reward comes later and the future, you know, the work comes now. The discounting function is something that economists have measured. It's kind of built into how all economic calculations are done. You can measure it in pigeons. Like, everything works this way. And you can see this hyperbolic discounting curve and kind of draw a lot of really basic and obvious conclusions from applying that. And when you start to use something like BMinder, where you commit to how much work you're going to put into your various goals, and you, the key aspect of BMinder I find is not the threat of the monetary penalty when you derail, because you put in there, it starts at $5. If you want to work out 3 times a week and you eventually don't work out on average 3 times a week, you pay $5 and it re-ups for 15. So the next time you don't do it, you pay 15 and then it goes to 30 and 90 and it triples each time. And until the point at which even when you don't really don't want to work out, you really don't want to pay $270. So you work out anyway. And then thus past you has forced future you to continue working out forever, or at least until you change your mind on your long-term goals. So that's one thing about BMinder that's really, really useful, is you can change your mind on what your goal should be, but you can only do it a week in the future. And if you still want the benefit a week in the future, you just don't want to pay the cost now. Well, tough, because you can't change it now. You can only change it in a week. So it gives you like the perfect blend of flexibility while still keeping your foot to the fire, that you can trust you're going to do what you said you would do. And that's key, right? The expectancy of success makes doing any sort of project or putting in the work so much easier. It's not even a question of motivation if you really think you're going to win. It's just a question of organization. And for that, the main point of BMinder is that as you set in, okay, I'm going to work out 3 times a week, I'm going to put 2 hours per day into my business on average, you have something that tells you exactly how much more you need to do to meet that commitment, so that there's no fuzzy logic, no rationalization, no weaseling out of it by saying, well, I'll do some more tomorrow. It's like, no, your average means that you need to do 0.34 hours more today or you fail. That bright line is absolutely important for not weaseling out of your word to yourself, when your word to yourself is actually the core product, and being able to trust that you would do what you said you would do. Absolutely critical if you want to work for yourself, run your own business, achieve your study goals, be personally productive, learn languages, have side projects, anything that you want to put into any sort of goal, you need to be able to trust your word to yourself. And that's what having a system that strengthens that word as opposed to risking it will do. So that's my love letter to BMinder, because I think it's the perfect combination of being able to specify clearly exactly what your goal is, as well as what you need, showing you every day what you need to do to be on track, so that you can not just forget or slack or kind of weasel out.
Yeah. And the other thing I liked when I did use BMinder, I haven't gotten to the habit of it, but whenever I tried to email to cancel a goal that I just decided I actually didn't want to have it for a vacation. I thought I added the vacation setting, but it still wanted to ding me. And then I emailed them and then they reply and they actually ask you, so why do you not want to do this anymore? And so they try and be an accountability coach to some degree about preventing you, but ultimately they'll still let you cancel it. But I've always found whenever I've used that or Stick K, that I've always found myself weaseling my way out of it and not really being able to successfully implement new habits and goals myself. Although many people look at me as somebody who is able to create a lot of good positive habits. And I have my three keystone habits every day, my meditation, my exercise, and my reading. But I've never been able to use external applications. And I'd actually go back to this idea of, I don't know, I think it's the contrast effect fallacy, where when we have something, we don't really care about it. But when something's taken away, then we want it more. And I feel like these external applications, they can kind of lock this desire away. But
yeah, there's different types of people. And some people will just weasel out of whatever they told BMinder they're going to do. And especially if you've built that habit with BMinder, then it might mean that BMinder is blocked off to you. what humans will do is they will have very compartmentalized expectations of themselves in various areas. So people might say, oh, I can never diet, it never works for me. And yet then they can go on to like learning a language and they have no problem spending 20 minutes a day or something like this. Or they think, oh, you know, I'm just incredibly socially anxious. I can never go out and talk to people and make friends. And, you know, then they're putting in the time when it comes to working on their business or something like that. And they don't generalize that like these activities in terms of putting in the effort and the time to improve are kind of like each other. You can just completely burn out on a certain area and thinking like, I will never be good at this. And it takes a lot to come back from that kind of expectancy of failure. And you can do that with specific tools, to-do lists, email inboxes, people, et cetera, where you kind of burned your bridge and you've lost trust in your word to that person, that tool, yourself, that process, whatever it is. But still be able to go and start fresh with a new person, tool, process, or kind of area and give it a good shot. As long as your brain's pretty good at compartmentalizing these like past histories of failure and success and not transferring them to other areas. And so what that means is if you try BeeMinder, you try Stick A, you try Accountability Buddies, you try any sort of system, give it a really good shot the first time, because if it doesn't work the first time, you're probably not going to be able to try again. You'll just have this like expectancy barrier in your way. But at the same time, if you fail on various strategies, processes, these things in the past, you can still find something that works for you as long as in your mind, it's like clearly different this time. But you should really try as hard as you can to succeed with that, because every time that you fail, it makes it a little bit harder on net to trust your general word to yourself. So if you're looking to try BeeMinder, like really try it. If you failed at it a few times in the past, try something else. Mm-hmm. If you're going to weasel out of your commitment to yourself on BeeMinder and you know that, then you could try saying adding in a personal accountability coach or something on top of it, or just doing something else. The BeeMinder team is really great because, and if you're running your own business, you may know this or have seen this somewhere. It's kind of the Paul Graham recommended approach to early stage startups and businesses. Just do really insanely great customer support. So if you contact the BeeMinder team at any time about anything, you will very quickly get a response where they just go out of their way, bend over backwards to help you with your problem, understand your need, et cetera, in a maximally fair way. And so this is really great for creating dedicated, loyal users, but also understanding their needs. You can't do that once you're super huge, but when you're small and you're just starting with your business, highly recommend it. It's one of the top things that I like about, I digress a little bit, but I just picked up this new mail client, Superhuman. Most efficient, most productive mail email client in the world by far. Some of the best software I've ever seen. I literally cried. It was so good. And part of the reason that makes it so good is kind of the white glove treatment that they're giving you, like onboarding you, explaining it, any sort of customer support thing. If you're running your own business, you taking this kind of approach is so, so powerful.
And what's the name of that software?
It's called Superhuman. If you go to superhuman.com, it's invite only, but I'm sure we can get some invite network going on. It's made me like twice as productive at email. And I spend a lot of time on email. Keyboard shortcuts for everything, just amazing design and extremely, extremely good onboarding. If you're looking for kind of inspiration for how to do viral marketing, onboarding for your users, customer support, kind of lifestyle business SaaS, like they've nailed everything. I'm so impressed. This is just my like latest like love software from the past 2 weeks. It's so great.
And I wanted to mention another company called commitaction.com, which is essentially a ability coach for entrepreneurs. I think it costs around $125 or $150 per month, but every week you have a call with an accountability coach where you give him your goals, and then they have an interface where they track out what your three intentions are for the week. And then you have the same call every time, every week. And I've actually found it to be helpful myself to help get me the motivation, because I feel that there's going to be a sense of embarrassment, or, you know, I'm not going to have my three goals done that I committed to prior in the week. And they make sure that you have, that you're setting specific goals. I know, you know, everybody follows a SMART philosophy, but you've mentioned the CSI philosophy. But I wanted to get into your email just for a sec and ask you, what is your process for email? Because a lot of people have email problems. And myself, I'd be addicted to my email, where I'd spent all day just answering emails, and then new ones come in, and then I feel like I get nothing done at the end of the day. How do you manage your email versus your time making stuff?
Well, it's a lot of little things, and I won't say I'm perfect. At a certain point, email load will overwhelm even the best processes, whereas anything can work when your email load is low. But, you know, all the usual things, right? Trying to do inbox zero is pretty good. The general get things done philosophy, where you touch each thing once. Sometimes something comes in, you're not ready to process it right now. Well, that's a pretty good signal. You shouldn't be looking at your email right then, because if you're not really ready to process emails, then what are you doing in your inbox? You're just getting distracted. You're getting a hit of like phantom productivity, but maybe you should be doing some focused work. And then set aside a big block of time for really ripping through your email and getting back to inbox zero. However, sometimes you got to check it, right? Something might come in. You're waiting on something. In the process of doing some focused work, you are needing to go in your inbox and look something up. So there's ways you can kind of block new messages from coming in at certain times of the day. You can start your day not checking your email. Definitely turn off your notifications so you're not getting notified of emails. And I try to do as much email as I can on my laptop, because it's inefficient on my phone. And then I can be present when I'm out and about, and then just have dedicated email time. Just extremely, extremely super productive, using all the keyboard shortcuts. Superhuman's amazing for this, for when you are actually doing email. One of the things that Superhuman does that Inbox also did, too bad Inbox is being discontinued, is you've got really good keyboard shortcuts and quick actions for kind of snoozing things, or moving things to a separate tab where you don't even see them, and unsubscribing for things, et cetera. So the goal, you want to get something to the right place where you're going to deal with it and get it out of your main email inbox, where you're kind of triaging new stuff that comes in and doing your work. So there's a lot of little tricks and how that can be set up, and you can do a lot to customize your inbox. What I found the Superhuman team has done is give me a default setup that actually has me checking my email less, spending less time in there, getting more done, ignoring unimportant messages until the right time, just kind of naturally by the way the user interface is designed. And it's a way that I could never get set up in Gmail or Inbox or any of the other things that I tried. But yeah, a lot of little tricks, tips, tactics, you got to put it all together. And sometimes still it isn't even enough if you get a ton of email. So it's a main challenge, honestly.
And even when it comes to say, customizing or learning the shortcuts, that I've had a thought experiment just thinking about. I remember every time I've seen or I've helped somebody on a computer, I can't recall the amount of times I've seen them say, open up Google Chrome and then type in google.com in the web browser, press enter, and then enter their search query. If people spent any amount of time trying to understand how can I make my workflow more efficient, then you know, just the amount of tiny minutes that they would probably save up over a lifetime, I'm not sure, is that worth it? And at what point can you perhaps do too much of it? Because I found myself obsessing over the preferences or workflow of a software and being actually more interested in configuring the software or finding the right software rather than using it effectively. And I think there's that aspect of when you're being productive, balancing that efficiency of input versus output.
Yeah, great point. I used to do the same thing where I would try to finagle every single setting to make my workflow super productive, whether or not I was spending a lot of time in that workflow or there were huge gains to be had. And I think making certain workflows really productive and let me like push the limits of kind of how I use the computer and keyboard shortcuts and automation, all that is helpful, but you can certainly take it too far. And when you invest a lot of time creating certain workflows, shortcuts, filters, et cetera, for a certain piece of software, if you ever switch that software, or maybe you're on a different computer that doesn't have it set up, like now you're worse than if you'd done nothing, right? Because you don't have any of the things you're used to. And so now I'm in a point where I customize less hard to customize customizations and don't spend as much time on that. But when a tool affords it, I will spend the time to learn that tool. Thing about Superhuman, and I hope more software starts to do this, is that every time you take any action, in the course of doing it, it will show you at the bottom what the keyboard shortcut for that action is. And there's keyboard shortcuts for everything. And even in their onboarding, they send a 30-day drip. On day 20 or something, you get like a little mini game, which is just keyboard shortcut practice, which is like super like 80s retro Space Invaders themed. It's like so hilarious. But then it makes you better at the keyboard shortcuts for that software, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I spent maybe like 20 minutes over the course of the last few weeks like explicitly learning about keyboard shortcuts, but I'm using them all the freaking time. So like there's ways that the tools can make it really easy to learn and customize and create good workflows, and there are ways that tools can get in your way, and most tools will still get in your way. And if you ever switch the tools, all that time is gone.
What would you consider, you know, Matt Mullenweg from WordPress, he took the time to learn the alternative keyboard layout. I forgot the name that's supposed to be more efficient than the one we have by default. Would you consider learning that? And because that would be a considerable amount of time you'd have to expend in order to change that. What's your view on that?
I've tried it. I tried learning Dvorak. I know that other people will go even further and do Colemak and all these other alternative layouts. I personally type so fast that if I were to switch to Dvorak, it would not be so much a typing speed increase as like an ergonomics increase, and which is potentially very helpful for RSI and carpal tunnel and these kind of things. However, when I started having trouble with that early on in my startup productivity hacking career, because I was just working so much, you know, and I started to try to solve that with more ergonomic chairs and keyboards and taking breaks and wearing these wrist cards and all that kind of stuff. And then I just found the popular advice whenever this comes up on Hacker News, which is that it's all, for a lot of people, that kind of pain is just there because you expect it to be there, and it's kind of stress manifesting in your wrist or something. And if you don't expect it to be there anymore, it goes away. And as soon as I read that, it went away, and I didn't have to deal with any of that crap. So I stopped learning Dvorak, which I'd only gotten up to like 45 words per minute, whereas at QWERTY, I'm like 110 or 120 or something like that. And just kind of chalk that up as something that might be useful for people who either type slower or have more RSI or need to type huge amounts of text, and so typing a tiny bit faster would be pretty useful. Or if you just like that kind of thing, it was kind of fun to learn. It kind of really warps your brain, like switching between the two, and you're like, whoa. But overall, at the end of the day, if you're already effective at QWERTY, I don't see that as the most efficient way to spend your time.
And as a side note to an earlier point, do you have an iPhone or an Android?
I have both. I primarily use iPhone. I have Android just to go to China because Google Fi bypasses the great firewall and is so great.
I used to be on Android when that first came out, but I would end up installing a custom ROM and modifying it. And I literally would spend like a whole day modifying my new phone, all for it to have to reload it 6 months later. Or I end up spending more time customizing than actually using it. And then when I got the iPhone, you know, there's a lot less customization, and I find that it just works more often. And I care less about customizing the device rather than just appreciating the fact it just does what I want it to the large majority of the time compared to Android. Just curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I know people who use really custom Android stuff and makes them super productive. And I know people like myself that take iPhone defaults for most things and spend very little time thinking about their phone. And I think you want to just weigh how much you actually want to do on your phone versus your computer or being present or something like that. For example, my wife, she is pro on her phone. Now, she uses an iPhone, but she'll customize it pretty well. She used to use Android, but I think she prefers the design because she's a designer, so she likes the design on iPhone a little more. Mm-hmm. But she will spend hours a day on that thing, and she's so much more effective, not just at kind of networking with her friends, but buying things and taking care of business. Like, she'll do anything on her phone that she could do on a computer, and it's not that much slower. So she's pro phone user, whereas me, if I'm on my phone doing something, if it's going to take more than a couple of minutes, if I'm being productive, I just want to get to my computer where I can be even more productive, and I'll wait and I'll do it there. And for that kind of approach, you got to think about where you want to spend your time and attention. My time and attention is not going to be spent optimizing my phone setup. I'm going to be optimizing my actual desktop laptop setup and ignoring kind of all the distracting things that you could be doing with your phone.
And speaking of being improductive, you mentioned earlier a 120-hour workweek experiment that you just got finished done with. Can you explain more about that?
I set up a thought experiment. I was just like, well, you know, I'm tracking how much work I do. I got my percentile feedback thing going on so that during the day I can motivate myself to do more. This is when I had like one overwhelming priority, because in an early stage startup, you just got to hack and write a lot of code. I was like, well, I could just be more focused on the important work. And so have a lot of goal tracking set up to see how much work I can get done. Cause that's the shorter calendar time I put this in, the more competitive we'll be, et cetera. There's just so much to do. So I got more and more and more and more and more productive writing code. And then I thought, like, well, okay, how much could I really do? Because it seemed to me that for every hour per day or hour per week that I worked over, you know, 40 hours, you know, I got more than 1 hour's worth of returns out of it, because it would stay in the zone longer. There'd be less context switching. There'd be less kind of weekly overhead of running the business and more time to just get into deep work on projects. And I thought, well, how much could I do in 1 week? If I just reduce all distractions, I just optimize everything for hacking to the max. And so I set up a time-lapse video, kind of recording my face and the screen to keep me honest. And I kind of optimized my sleep schedule so that I would start at 4 a.m. on Monday, and then I would go and kind of sleep later and later. So I'd only have 6 nights of sleep instead of 7. I would end at 3:59 a.m. on kind of the next Monday, right? And didn't check my email inbox the whole time, didn't get on social media, didn't leave the house, didn't do anything except work on code and eat like pre-prepared meals that I'd cooked and then sleep.
It sounds like you were in flow.
I was in flow the entire time. And it was super interesting because the other thing I did was I measured my happiness, energy, and health stats on a 1 to 10 scale randomly every few hours throughout the experiment. And it was the happiest week that I've ever recorded in, you know, many, many years of tracking this sort of thing, because it's so much fun to be in flow.
Could you do that every week?
I couldn't, because it was so much work that I just, well, first I had to prep for it. So the previous week I didn't get as much done because I was like getting on the right sleep schedule and making meals, et cetera, and putting out all the fires that I wouldn't have to pay attention in email for a week. And then next week I just crashed. I need to sleep. So 120 was too much to do every week, but I estimate that I got like somewhere around 4.5 real weeks worth of work in that 1 week, just because I got more and more productive, maybe even more. And I wrote some really, really just a huge amount of code that ended up being really good stuff. So I don't think it's like overall good to work that much. It's just impossible physically to work that much. But to find a balance where you can take care of your maintenance and then you can get into flow and eliminate all distractions, that's something that kind of a few readers have taken up, and they call it the maniac weeks. And so you can say, all right, I just need to push whatever my project is forward. They'll do a maniac weekend. They'll do a whole week. They'll clear out every possible distraction, get into flow on their main thing, and make a huge amount of progress. People use this on writing their dissertations. They'll use it on working on their startups, whatever they want to do. It's especially good for coding.
And I think you also have a higher degree of motivation. You're able to obtain that longer because you're making progress more quickly on a goal. In the past, I had this idea of like, let me build multiple businesses at once, and that each week I'll subdivide my time. And I just had no motivation to do any of it because I didn't feel like I was making progress. And so I think that's such a big piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. I mean, like, how much more motivation you get when instead of like, I'll move a little bit closer to shipping this thing, which I'll do next quarter, to like, I'm just going to go all day and all the next day, and I'm going to have this entire new huge feature done. Like, I'll see it tomorrow. Or, you know, oh, there's this huge bug backlog. I forget exactly the numbers. I had hundreds of bugs in the backlog. And the last couple of days, I just fixed bugs. I fixed like 150 bugs or something like that. And I was like, all right, bug backlog gone. Skoosh, right? I was like so psyched. You just get on a roll. But I can't do that anymore because now I have a wife and kids that we would not be meritably okay to disappear for a week and just hack that.
I'm curious on that note. I'm sure you're a fan of Elon Musk, and you know, recently he was in the news for being noted for sleeping at work and even having to take Ambien to go to sleep. It seemed like, you know, in some ways, I think it humanizes Elon that, you know, he's somebody just like us. And, you know, I know that he has a family and kids. I'm curious, what's your thoughts about that? Or why do you think he's at that level? Would you ever foresee yourself having to stay in the office sleeping at night and spending less time with your family? Would you ever consider that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really easy to see how he would get in that situation, because at that level, he's got 5 kids, right, in his family. And he can choose to spend his time with them, or he can choose to spend his time kind of putting out some fire or pushing forward on some business of his that he thinks is going to ultimately guarantee the survival of the human race in the case of catastrophic existential risk. Mm-hmm. And so something comes up and he just makes the call that, no, you know, getting a few hours more here in the office to handle whatever this thing is going to be more useful for my goals than going back and see my family and getting no sleep. And, you know, that compounds over time where, and then he ends up in this kind of horrible sleep debt where his family, he doesn't have as much time for them. And he's just like exhausted at all times. However, in the short term, probably most of those decisions he made were good decisions. And given the speed at which his businesses have grown, like, you can't argue with some of his results. And I'm sure if you step into his shoes, you can see the incredible pressures he's going to face making those calls. At the same time, the best decision that he could have made would be to just not have kids while trying to run these two incredibly ambitious companies, because that makes it much, 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 much harder.
And how do you balance somewhat, say, you know, you're running a startup, you're familiar with the pressure of, you know, working yourself, but then I've run into a lot of times where I didn't realize it at the time, but I was burning myself out. And then I just would wake up one morning and I would look at everything I have to do and I couldn't do it. And it took me a long time before I could start to recognize this recurring feeling of burnout. And for somebody like Elon, which, you know, we don't know if he experiences burnout, he probably does, but to us, it seems like he's just incredibly productive. He's able to live on 6 hours of sleep and he's just able to go to work every single day. Have you experienced burnout? Kind of, how do you balance this productivity? And third question later on is, do you believe in a work-life balance?
Yeah, burnout. Interesting. I've come a little bit close certain times. Usually that was when the rewards for my work got too far away from the work I was doing. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I was developing the Skritter iPhone app and we had had a web version and we needed to go mobile and we wanted to be really, really good. And we ended up on this, like, I don't know, it took us like a year and a half. And, you know, I'm like 6 months, 12 months into that. I have no users because it still isn't usable. There's a huge bug backlog. I still feel so far away. I just got incredibly demotivating. What I ended up doing was saying, all right, forget all this stuff and that kind of is the right order to build these features in and fix these bugs in. I'm going to drop everything until I can get a beta out to users. Because as soon as I have users that are using this and working with it and asking me for stuff, then it comes like, oh, I can get that to the user that asked for it today, as opposed to, all right, well, I'll need this feature in 6 months when I can sort of launch it, right? And that made all the difference, right? Similarly, when getting close to burnout, right, you know, you got to look at your motivation and which components of that are missing. Do you not value what you're doing? Do you not expect that it's going to work? Is the delay just really, really far away? Or is there too much other stuff distracting you that's going on? And you can kind of optimize for those factors and consciously design or redesign your productivity, redesign your lifestyle until those factors are in sync instead of at odds and the burnout can go away.
Where do you find that level of introspection and metacognition in order to really understand how you're feeling and what's working, what's not, right? Because some people, they'll be burned out for years or they'll be depressed for years. And it might actually just end up being this one thing that they just didn't take time to think about. Where did you develop that ability?
Well, the main thing for me was to do the experiential sampling. So I would ping myself every few hours. I use some custom software I wrote, but you could use a number of iOS apps, Android apps, whatever. And you just ask, how are you feeling? What are you doing? You can measure this like 1 to 10 on your happiness scale. If you have health or energy problems, you can also do health or energy. Just some tags on what's going on. And then do some quick correlations on that. Because if you think back on how you felt about certain things, you're just wrong. And if you think forward to how you feel are going to feel about things, you're also going to be wrong. Because you have this entirely different planning mode and remembering mode that's different from how you actually experience things. It's the same reason why you'll think back as to why a vacation was like so amazing, because there was like this 5 minutes at the top of the mountain that were like the best, right? But you don't actually realize that most of your vacation was like toil and low-grade discomfort and boredom of travel, et cetera. So doing that kind of experiential sampling let me really understand what kind of made me happy, made me unhappy, made me productive, not. And that level of introspection, you know, you kind of need to do that because humans are terrible at remembering and planning, and you need to use this other mode if you're going to correct for that and make good decisions on how you should spend your time. The other piece would be to just try to cover the basics. So if you're not sleeping enough, you probably everything's going to be better if you sleep more. You're going to be more productive and happier and healthier. So an extra hour of work versus the last hour of sleep that you need. Get the hour of sleep. Prioritize almost everything about that. Same thing for nutrition and diet, exercise. You have to be healthy enough if you're going to have the energy you need to do anything successfully. So you got to get those basics in place. If you have kind of anxiety, depression, any other sorts of problems, you know, you can work on those because solving those will make everything else easier. If you are in a rut and you can't kind of introspect, retrospect, figure out what's going on with those, get a change of scenery, like get on a plane flight like I did. Just take a day off, go to the park, think about stuff. I was just in a sensory deprivation tank yesterday. I took my first day off in forever. I did like a cryo spa, infrared sauna, and then an hour long sensory deprivation tank float. And I was just chilling, trying to relax. And all of a sudden, I came to a huge amount of clarity on like several important philosophical life decisions while just sitting there, because it took that hour of not having anything else intrude to just let my brain think about that. And it came to clarity. And I think people who have a meditation habit maybe are way ahead of me on this. I've just never been able to develop one. But just getting yourself in a different setting. If it's too hard, you can even set yourself a concrete goal to make enough time to go and introspect, right? You don't put that on your calendar, put that in your Beeminder. I had to do this. I don't normally introspect. I had to like explicitly make a productivity goal of it to step away from faraway thoughts.
And for those who don't know, a deprivation tank is it's just kind of a box that you sit in full of lukewarm water. So it's the same temperature as your skin and there's no light and you just sit there naked kind of in this little tank. And it allows you to not have any of these external senses because we're always processing these external stimuli. And just to have this space, you end up having to retract into your own head. And in many ways that people say it's kind of a precursor to any kind of psilocybin or any kind of drugs is to be alone in your own head in those tanks and see kind of how you are. And in myself, I actually have my own routine at the end of every night where I end up whenever I sold my last company, I bought this $10,000 and not a massage chair. And I was a little questioning at the time, but every night before I go into bed, you know, we end up having, as Tim Ferriss say, we get this monkey mind where we can't go to sleep and we keep on thinking about our anxieties about the future and what happened today. And I like to have sort of like, I have my meditation in the morning to clear my head. I'll have this opposite of meditation at the end of the night where I get in the massage chair and it's a heated blanket. And I have these little things I put over my eyes that I can heat in the microwave. And I put a mitt in my mouth and I put on lavender. And so I'm sort of invading all my senses, but also depriving it in a way. And I just end up retreating into my own head for that 15 minutes. And at the end of the day, sometimes I have these amazing revelations about something that happened in my life because I'm actually letting my anxieties out on that chair in that separate location, not on my bed. And then sometimes I don't even remember getting out of the chair into my bed and being able to go to sleep. And so I sort of see this as it's been hugely beneficial for me to have that introspection process at the end of the day where I'm analyzing kind of what happened, because we always have anxieties and we always think like, oh, we should have done this or we should have done that. But we end up taking that with us into our bed and then we have insomnia. So definitely for myself, as well as you, you've seen it. Introspection is just incredibly important because you can make leaps and bounds in terms of what's wrong with your life instead of just, you know, you get that big picture perspective instead of just always being down in the rut and focusing on what's in front of you.
Exactly, Zach. And there's so many ways to do that. You know, there's the sensory deprivation, there's the massage, there's the meditation. You can go on walks, you can go to coffee shops, you can journal, you can do therapy, you can talk it out with a buddy, go on a run. I mean, whatever it is, you know, you can find your groove, some way to think, reflect, and get out of the day to day. It's so key.
And on that note, I'd like to probably at the end of the podcast here, is there any last words that you want to leave my audience with?
Great question. I think one of the things that I see over and over, a lot of people will read my book and they will write to me and say, oh man, that's a really great book. I'm so inspired. I'm going to do all this stuff. And I write back and I say, okay, that's great. Feel free to keep me posted kind of what motivation missions you're going to go on. What are your goals? And despite having just read the book, you know, people will send me all sorts of stuff where they don't have specific goals yet, or they don't have concrete measurable actions, or they formulate their goals in a way that is going to, I can see, will make them not succeed because there's no kind of next action, just some sort of stuff. And you can go through all this productivity literature, all this productivity porn as you have it, And there's so many different ways to do it, but you actually have to do it. The default human biases are to kind of not follow through and not kind of commit and to kind of form goals or habits or something that kind of leave you a way out that is not really taking any of the advice of whatever productivity or goal setting structure you just read about. And maybe it doesn't work. And then you go on to a new one and you try that and you still didn't really commit. And it's a little bit difficult to read these things and then analyze, okay, so SMART goal means, okay, actually this goal isn't times bounded. Okay. This one isn't specific enough. This one isn't measurable. Like, oh, well, I've just read this thing on my 7 habits of highly successful people. And I think this is, and you don't actually follow through and do it quite all the way. And when that happens, then you are kind of depriving yourself at a chance to succeed or a chance to kind of level up your life. You don't need a whole ton of these things. You just need one or maybe a couple, and then to like just really follow through and do those. Any of those things can lead you to absolute great success compared to almost all the people in life who never do this. They're never strategic about what they want out of life, and they never kind of commit to following some path that's going to get them that and make a process for which they improve. If all you do is that, if you actually follow some process that you cook up that can improve itself and you stick to it, don't fall prey to all the kind of rationalizations and excuses that will try to dissuade you. So much can be accomplished and can be yours. And I see a lot of my readers actually do this, and they do stuff that's totally different from kind of what I do. But they have some sort of process that they're really committing to and following, and they get crazy amounts of stuff done. They're super impressive. And I think so many people are capable of that and become incapable the more approaches they kind of half-heartedly commit to and fail at. So if you take away anything, what I want you to take away is that the next system that you try, you should go all in as your last chance. And if you do that, whatever system it is, you're probably going to succeed big beyond anything you can dream of. And if you don't, it's just going to get harder and harder the next time. So that's my challenge to you.
Yeah. Wow. That is an amazing challenge. And I want to add on to it, even though I feel like I shouldn't, that there's been times whenever I'll have a habit, you know, if we want to lose weight, you know, it's everything that we try is essentially, it's an experiment, you know? And so somebody they might feel bad, but then they don't really introspect and ask, where is this feeling coming from, and solving that issue, because maybe it's they were bullied as a kid for being overweight, and then they carried that anxiety with them, but they have this anxiety of like, let me lose weight, let me try this diet pill, oh, it doesn't work, let me try this exercise, oh, it doesn't work. A part of it is because you don't have the motivation to carry it through. And there's been times when I've just absolutely, like, I started a reading habit overnight, I started exercising every single day just after seeing these other successful people, what they were doing, and then just committing to it and just thinking in my head, how bad do I really want this? And that's part of the issue, I think, is that we all have these internal desires, but we don't necessarily sit down with ourselves and say, this is really what I want right now. Because if we can do that, we can almost accomplish anything. And that's what I see lack, is that commitment and that intent. And even thinking about the feelings and where is this idea of that desire coming from?
True, true.
But Nick, we could talk for hours, but I'll end it there. Thank you again for joining me on this podcast. I've had an amazing conversation with you. And where can people go to follow more or listen to more of your content?
Thanks, Cody. It's been a great conversation. If you want to check out my stuff, just go to nickwinter.net. And if you want to get in touch, my email's on that page. Let's jam.
Okay, great. Nick, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hey guys, this is Cody again. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Mind Hack. And if you're interested in getting more Mind Hack worthy stuff straight to your inbox, then you might consider signing up for my weekly newsletter. It often contains links to new episodes, blog posts, and other interesting finds I found on the interweb in the past week. It pretty much focuses around productivity and efficiency. So if that's your thing, then be sure to visit my website at codymclain.com. That's MCLAIN.com to sign up. Also, if there are any interesting websites, companies, books, blog posts, quotes, or anything else that was mentioned in this episode, you can find it all in more by visiting the official website for the Mindhack Show at mindhack.com. And as always, if you have any feedback, good or bad, I want to hear it. Send me a tweet, email, or what have you on either of my websites, as my goal with this show is to give you the maximum value in the shortest amount of time. That's all for now, guys. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you guys again soon.